Brigitte Gabriel is a national security analyst, a New York Times best-selling author, and the chairman of ActForAmerica.org, which is an advocacy group that opposes Islamic extremism. She doesn't beat around the bush. I have been watching various things that Brigitte has been doing on the internet for years. I said to her when I first spoke to her just a minute or two ago that this is for me a culmination of probably close to 15 years of wanting to meet her, to speak to her, to hear her thoughts on the most recent current affairs, and to hear how her positions may or may not have changed over the years. She has an incredible life story, and it is an absolute pleasure to welcome her to our show today. So, Brigitte, thank you.
Thank you, Gareth, for having me with you. I'm honored to be with you today.
Well, to give people a bit of background here, because I think your story, even though so many people all over the world must have already heard it, I know you got 2 million people who follow you and pay attention to everything that you're doing, not just with ACT, but your own media career, which has been long and full of flourish and amazing, incredible achievement. But you're a Lebanese-American. You were born in Lebanon, South Lebanon. You had to flee. I'm giving a very brief synopsis here, but it deserves a little bit of time. So perhaps the best thing you can do is just start off for people in South Africa, particularly who don't know your story, just to tell them how you got involved in everything since 9/11 and how you became a voice for the things that you espouse so passionately.
Well, thank you. Okay, buckle down for the ride. Here it comes. Here is the story. No, truly. I mean, my life, I was born into privilege in Lebanon. I was born living the American dream. I'm an only child to a couple who was married for over 22 years. They could not have any children. And after 22 years of marriage, here I show up into their life at the later years of their lives as a miracle in their life. My father was a businessman. He had retired from the government, took all his money and built real estate with it. We owned the biggest, most famous restaurant in southern Lebanon. So I was born with a chauffeur to drive me to school and help in the house. I was truly born into the Lebanese dream. Unfortunately.
Sorry, just before you go on, because people also don't know a huge amount about Lebanon, unless like you, they've either lived there or they've studied it. I mean, Lebanon is a country full of contrasts. And the Lebanon we see today is not the one you were born into. You were born into a Christian Lebanese family, Maronite Christian, I presume. This is a thing that most people don't associate with Lebanon anymore.
That's a great question. Thank you for bringing that point up. I was born into a Christian family. Lebanon was the only majority Christian country in the Middle East. When we got our independence from France, over 70% of the population were Christian. Unfortunately, all that began to change as we started importing people into our country who did not share our values. And also, Muslims in Lebanon, the majority are Shiite, multiply at a much faster pace than we do. You know, we Christians, get married, have, you know, 3-4 children. By the time our kids are born, we start thinking what college we're going to send them to, what schools we're going to send them to, what life we're going to give them. Muslims, especially Shiites, on the other hand, are allowed to marry up to 4 wives at a time, not in a lifetime. All a Muslim man has to do is say, I divorce you 3 consecutive times to his wife. And he divorces her. And that's it. You know, you're divorced, talak, 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 and that's it. And then he marries another woman. And so they have multiple children. Some families have up to 50 children. We in the West cannot fathom that level of multiplication. When you think of Osama bin Laden was 1 out of 53 children. Osama bin Laden himself has 28 children. So how many Christians do you know, or Jews, or Buddhists, or Hindus have, 28 children, 25 children, not to mention 53 children. So over the years in Lebanon, that began to tip the scale. Now, Lebanon, the Lebanon that I was born into, was known as Paris of the Middle East, the banking capital of the Middle East. We were open-minded. We were fair. We were tolerant. We were multicultural. We prided ourselves on our multiculturalism. We had open borders. We welcomed everyone into our country from the Arabic world. Arabs sent their children to study in our universities because we had built the best universities in the Middle East. They graduated and worked in our economy because we had built the best economy in the Middle East, even though we did not have any oil. Lebanese Christians are very smart in business. You know, there are many Lebanese Christians in Africa, all over Africa, and they prosper and they build businesses. Lebanon is also a republic, very much like the United States, which is very different in a sea of Arab dictators, you know what I call the Middle East, Arabs with flags. You can identify every country by one man regime or one royal family. And you know, tribes with flags, that's the Middle East, with the exception of two countries, Lebanon, which used to be majority Christian country, and Israel, which is the majority Jewish country. My 9/11 happened to me in 1975 when radical Palestinian terrorists at the time blew up my home, bringing it down, burying me under the rubble wounded. I ended up in a hospital for 2.5 months and later ended up living with my parents in a bomb shelter underground in an 8 by 10 room without electricity, without water, and very little food. And that's where I lived, Gareth, for the next 7 years of my life, robbed of my youth from the age of 10 till the age of 17, as I was surrounded by Islamic terrorists wanting to kill me. We became prisoners to our towns. Life became unbearable. The Palestinians, which we had imported into Lebanon as refugees, put their heads together with the majority now Muslims in Lebanon, and they declared war on the Christians. You know, a lot of people called it the civil war. It wasn't the civil war. It was a war between the Lebanese Christians trying to protect and maintain their democracy and preserve their republic, and the majority refugees that we have imported and Islamists who came to fight with them from all over the Middle East because they wanted to establish a base in Lebanon from which to fight Israel, kill the Jews, and throw them into the sea. Something that Yasser Arafat failed to do in Jordan, and something that the Palestinians failed to do in Lebanon until the establishment of Hezbollah in Lebanon in 1983, where Khomeini came to power in 1979. He looked at Lebanon and he realized, you know, we've got a bunch of Shiites in Lebanon, we've got a bunch of Shiites in Syria, in Iraq, but let's take all these Islamists in Lebanon because by 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, we had 11 Islamic terrorist organizations operating out of Lebanon, including the PLO. So Khomeini in Iran looked at Lebanon and said, you know, all these Muslims, everybody's just screaming from a different direction. Why don't we bring them all together under one umbrella and call it Hezbollah, the party of Allah? And that's when Hezbollah was created in 1983. And today, Lebanon is a terrorist hellhole, completely controlled by Hezbollah. The Lebanese people think they still have a government, think they still have a country, which they don't. Hezbollah is in the government, elected democratically, because remember, we are a republic, elected democratically. They're a terrorist organization funded by Iran that runs the country. And now, again, they're trying to make war with Israel, kill the Jews, and throw them into the sea.
I'm glad that you mentioned the Lebanese because we've got a big community in South Africa of Lebanese people who I'm sure, like you, wish they could go back. You can never go back there, can you?
I can never go back there. Hezbollah wants my head on a platter, especially because I'm a terrorism analyst and speak the way I speak. But I am able to speak freely the way I do, differently than most Lebanese, is because I'm an only child, my parents died, and I don't have anybody. So Hezbollah cannot threaten my family left in Lebanon, my mom, my dad, my sisters, my cousins, my uncles, my whatever, that they're going to come kill you if she says anything. So I am free to speak the way I speak without fear. Most Lebanese cannot speak the way I do because their families in Lebanon will be threatened and killed.
You do speak, and I can't commend you enough on those clips that I saw so many years ago because you said something which has always stuck with me. You said and you articulate it better than anyone else. It doesn't take a majority of people to bring about change, good or bad. It just takes a tiny, intransigent minority of people. And I've thought about that so many times when it comes to politics here in South Africa, when it comes to the US, when it comes to Israel, when it comes to the Middle East at large, even wars like Russia and Ukraine. And I think about that so often. And you came upon that fact a long time ago in a debate, in fact, when someone said to you, oh, but the majority of Muslims are good, peace-loving, kind, caring people who don't have an issue with the other people of the Middle East or the rest of the world.
And I am sure there are, absolutely, but they are irrelevant. 2% of the passionate will always overrule the 98% indifferent. I want people to remember that quote. And you can quote me on that. I have actually that on my website. 2% of the passionate will always overrule the 98% indifferent. When you and I talk about terrorism in the world, we're talking about ISIS, we're talking about Al-Qaeda. Yes, they are a minority, but they're driving the news. Look, you and I are speaking, and Taylor Swift's concert in Austria was just canceled in three different locations because of a terrorist threat by ISIS. We're not talking about the majority of Muslims living peacefully in South Africa, or the majority of Muslims living peacefully in Australia, or in Canada, or in America. We're talking about ISIS, who threatened to commit a terrorist attack in a concert in Austria that was canceled because of the minority. When you look at all the lessons in history, when you look at, if we can learn from history, when you look at Germany, for example, the most identified evil regime under Hitler, which dragged the world into World War II, most Germans were peaceful. Yet the Nazis drove the agenda. And as a result of the Nazis' radical ideology, they dragged the whole world into war. 60 million people died, 14 million in concentration camp, 6 million were Jews. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at communist China, most Chinese were peaceful. Yet communist China was able to kill 70 million people. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at Russia, for example, most Russians were peaceful. Yet Russia was able to kill 20 million people. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at Japan prior to World War II, most Japanese were peaceful. Yet Japan was able to kill 12 million people, mostly killed bayonets and shovels. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at the United States on 9/11/2001, we had 2.3 million Muslims living in the United States on that day. It took only 19 hijackers, 19 out of 2.3 million people, to bring America down to its knees, destroy the World Trade Center, kill almost 3,000 people, bring America and airline travel to a shrieking halt, and the peaceful majority were irrelevant. So when we look at the lessons of history, Gareth, we have to be able to speak the truth about the threat of the radical minority that are crazy, who are willing to kill themselves and you, killing themselves in the process because they hate you so much and they believe they are driven by an ideology that justifies your murder and them committing suicide for the cause. Unless we speak this boldly, we're going to lose our nations and we're going to lose millions of people.
It gives me goosebumps to think about how you talk about 9/11 and what that did to you. That was the day you discovered your purpose, you say, and it's no small thing. And I don't want to gloss over it. Like, unfortunately, we had to rush through your life story. I encourage everybody to read your books. I mean, your books
Especially
are.
my book, Because They Hate. My book, Because They Hate, details my life story. The book sold over 1 million copies, and I encourage you to read it. You can get it through any site on Amazon. You can hear it on audio. It's recorded in my voice. People heard the glimpse for 5-10 minutes of my life. They need to read the book to understand where my passion comes from.
I do want to focus, if you don't mind, on this idea of Islam, because you've positioned yourself and, to your detriment, I'm sure it's cost you. I'm sure there are places that you definitely can't go. There are probably hit lists with your name near the top of it. Your bravery and your courage, to me, is interpreted by some people to be this word Islamophobia. And I remember Christopher Hitchens saying while he was still alive, that this is a ruse, this idea of Islamophobia. It is not possible to equate this with racism or with sexism, because this is a nebulous group of people. There aren't any outright defining characteristics. And by the way, if you go after the actual doctrines of the faith of Islam, then of course you are called many worse things than that, you know, infidel and heaven knows what else. How do you respond to claims that you should be ignored because you're Islamophobic, because you're criticizing a religion of peace?
Look, I started my media career in 1984. So I've been doing this for decades, for 40 years. So you never heard me talk about Islam in particular up until 9/11 because I don't have any problem with Muslims. I don't have any problem with religion. You can worship a cow's tush as far as I'm concerned. Good for you, good on you. I don't care. Religion is something so personal between you and your God. You can worship a monkey, you can worship a rock, good on you. I don't give a flying kite. What I care about is when your ideology comes out to kill me and my children. And actually, when I started ACT for America, my organization, which is now the largest national security organization in the United States, I started ACT for America because of terrorism. We are a national security organization. It just happens that the terrorist attacks around the world were perpetrated by Islamists. Look, the terrorist attack everybody in the news is talking about right now this week in Austria, canceling Taylor Swift's concert, is not Buddhists, it's not Hindus, it's not Jews, it's not Christians. It's ISIS who adheres to an Islamic ideology based in the Quran. The reason why they're talking about it in the news is because of Islamists threatened to blow up 3 million people who are attending her concert. That's why we're talking about it. So we need to make sure we differentiate between people and ideology. There are a lot of, look, in Christianity, there are a lot of different sects of Christians. There are the Catholics, there are the Maronites, the Protestant, the Church of England, the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, you name it. And everybody thinks differently. You've got from the very, very tolerant, moderate left who can have lesbians and gays as priests standing on the altar giving a church service to the evangelicals who believe you're going to burn in hell if you are gay and live a lifestyle. But they all call themselves Christians. But none of them want to kill you. They want to love you to death. They want to pray for you to death because, oh my gosh, we're going to pray for you because we love you. You are a sinner. You need to repent. Ask Jesus to love you because, you know, Jesus will forgive all your sins. But none of them want to kill you because of whatever you believe. When you look at Islamists on the other side, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram, or, you know, you go down the alphabet soup of radical Islamic terrorist groups around the world, Islamic Jihad, Hamas, it doesn't matter. They want to kill you because of what you believe, because of what your faith is, what your religion is, whether you practice it or not, it doesn't matter. And so this is why I talk about radical Islamic terrorism. I'm not against people. I love all people. You have Muslims in America, Black Muslims, who don't even speak Arabic, who have never read the Quran, who do not cannot tell you what's in the Quran, but they love the Islamic religion because of the structure. For them, it's a faith base. That's why we as Blacks, we like the structure. It keeps our guys out of crime. That's why we identify as Muslims, because we believe, you know, that's what they say. Islam is an African religion, and that's why we adopt it. Now, Blacks in America do not want to kill you because you are not a Muslims. Their idea of Islam is totally different. So when I talk about radical Islamic terrorism, I'm talking about the Islamists who are using the ideology which have been used against non-Muslims throughout history in order to kill non-Muslims. And that's when I talk about in its relationship to terrorism. When they come after us to kill us, we have to discuss the ideology that it's driving them to come out and kill us. When ISIS threatens to bomb 3 million young people attending a Taylor Swift concert in Austria to the point where Taylor Swift had to cancel her concert because somebody wants to kill 3 million people who are there to be at a concert, not to kill Muslims, not because they are espousing radical ideology. They're there to enjoy a concert. When you're dealing with people that radical, you have to speak up.
You also speak out very openly and frankly about your support for Israel. And perhaps you can explain to us, first of all, your own personal connection with Israel. You're not a Jew and you're not an Israeli, but you did spend some time in your life as a refugee there. And there's nowhere else you could have gone after you fled southern Lebanon.
Actually, I wasn't there as a refugee. I was there as a Lebanese journalist. And here is the difference. You see, when the war started in Lebanon and the whole world forgot about us, we were being massacred, we were being killed. And in my town in particular, in southern Lebanon, I actually grew up, Garrett, in the security zone they are talking about now, where Israel is going to go in 30 kilometers into Lebanon and establish the buffer zone from the Litani River to protect their pushing Hezbollah out. I grew up in that zone. And in that zone, because we were the only Christian towns left in the south, the Islamists with the Palestinians surrounded us to slaughter us. So we knew if we go to the Jews and beg for help, because we lived 5 kilometers from the Israeli border, because remember, Israel was the enemy at that time. Israel is an enemy of Lebanon. We don't have peace together. Lebanon was one of the countries that attacked Israel in the Six-Day War. But we knew as Christians, if we go to the border and beg the Jews for help, the Jews are not going to slaughter us because we had more shared values with them than we had with the Islamists. So a few people from my town went to Israel and begged Israel for help. And Israel from 1978 started coming in the middle of the night into Lebanon. Bringing support for the Christians, bringing food for the children because the Muslims cut off all our food supplies, bringing bomb shelters to those who did not have bomb shelters, taking the Christian men and teaching them how to fight. Because look, the Christian men in Lebanon were the educated ones. You know, they were not the street thugs. And we learned very quickly that you can have all your professional degrees on the wall behind you, your accounting degree, your medical degree, your law degree, your whatever degree. None of that will do you any good when you are faced with an enemy bent on slaughtering you in the name of their religion. So Israel was our only lifeline. If anybody got ill and needed treatment, Israel, we went to Israeli hospitals and got treated. So I knew that we were alive and being protected because Israel, who's supposedly our enemy, came to protect us and work with us. And they protected, by the way, the Christians, the Muslims, the Shiites who lived in the buffer zone, everybody. They provided work. Christians, Muslims, Shiites were able to go into Israel and work because Lebanon cut us off completely because now Lebanon called us traitors because we had peace with Israel. And so I ended up moving to Israel. Actually, I'll take it a little bit back. In 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, the Palestinians and the Islamists, as they were retreating, were shelling our zone frantically. And Israel, working with the Christians, trying to help the Christians take back their democracy and reestablish their democracy in Lebanon and kick out the radical Islamic element that had taken control of the country at that time. Like I mentioned earlier, Lebanon had 11 Islamic terrorist organizations operating out of Lebanon in 1982, including the PLO. So Israel, working with the Christians, went all the way into Beirut to help kick out that radical element out of the country. And they were able to kick out Yasser Arafat and his cronies all the way to Tunisia. That's how we came out of the bomb shelter and back to rebuilding our lives. During that invasion in 1982 on Operation Litani, as the Palestinians and Islamists were retreating, they were shelling us frantically. My mother became wounded by a shell exploding in front of our bomb shelter as she was running to the bomb shelter from our home. For my mom, we had to take her to Israel for treatment because we had nowhere else to go. For my mother, it was a life-saving opportunity. For me, it was a life-changing opportunity. I remember going to the Lebanese hospital. And my father had pulled $60 out of the mattress. And he said, here is $60 in case you need it, in case you need to go to Israel. And I remember touching money for the first time because when you're living in a bomb shelter, you don't go shopping. And I took that money, put it in my pocket. We went to the Lebanese hospital, which was a room out of the bombed out hospital that Israel had fixed up. They put a doctor there and two nurses on duty to help people, give them first aid until they can be taken to a hospital. They gave my mother first aid. They put her in an Israeli donated ambulance, and we drove to the border, which was about a 10-minute drive. We flew under the bombs as the Islamists and Palestinians were shelling us. We got to the border. They took my mother out of the ambulance and put her into another Israeli ambulance inside Israel to take her to the nearest hospital, which was Itzfat Hospital, to give her treatment. And you're going to be hearing a lot about Itzfat Hospital, because when Hezbollah starts shelling Israel, that hospital is the only main hospital in northern Israel that can take care of people. The Lebanese driver walked around the ambulance and asked me if I had any money. And he knew my parents. He was, an acquaintance of the family. And like an innocent 17-year-old teenager, I pull all the money out of my hand and I give it to him. And I said, "How much do I owe you?" And he looks at my money and he says, "Give me 30," which was half the money I had. I give him 30. I thank him very much for his service. He said, "This is the fee for the ambulance ride." Of course, I understood. Now, they put us inside another Israeli ambulance and drove us 1 hour to the Israeli hospital. And we were driven by a soldier who was a reservist who was just called into the service. We got into the hospital in Israel in front of the emergency room. They took my mother out and took her into the emergency room. And I walked around to the Israeli driver thinking to myself, "My gosh, if the 10-minute ride cost me $30, I'm sure I'm not going to have enough for the 1 hour ride." And I took my money out of my pocket and I offered it to the Israeli soldier and I said, "How much do I owe you?" And he looked at my money and he said, "What is this for?" And I said, "It's for the ambulance fee for the ride." And he said, "Oh no, you don't owe me anything. This is a free service from us to you. You keep your money and you take good care of your mother, and I wish her a speedy recovery." And I thought to myself, wow, I was so touched that this man, who doesn't know me from Adam, doesn't know anything about me, was so kind to me, and then, and told me that the ambulance ride was free. And then I became angry because I realized the Lebanese driver stole my money. That was my first lesson in the difference between the Arabic culture and the Israeli culture. We got into the emergency room in the hospital, and there were hundreds of people wounded in the emergency room. Muslims brought in from Lebanon, Christians brought in from Lebanon, Palestinian terrorists brought in from Lebanon, Israeli soldiers wounded brought in from Lebanon. The doctors treated everyone according to their injury. They did not see religion. They did not see political affiliation. They did not see nationality. They treated people according to their needs. The doctor treated my mother before he treated the Israeli soldier, laying next to her because my mother's injury was more severe. I couldn't believe my eyes. We ended up going to the fourth floor of the hospital, and they put my mother into a room where two other ladies had been brought in from Lebanon that same morning, one Muslim, one Druze. And, they put my mother in the room, and we were there maybe 5 minutes, and I heard all this commotion outside of our window. And I walked out to the balcony to see what was going on, and people were running through our room from the hallway, going out to the balcony to see what was happening. And I walk out, and two Israeli helicopters had just landed, bringing in Israeli soldiers wounded in Lebanon, taking them on stretchers, one after another, into the emergency room. And Gareth, I stood at that hospital balcony, looking down, feeling sick to my stomach, feeling embarrassed, humiliated, sad that these people are wounded because of the war with my country. I didn't make eye contact with anyone standing next to me because I did not know how they're going to react to me. And I was surrounded on the hospital balcony by mothers of Israeli soldiers who were brought in from Lebanon who were wounded in the hospital, sisters, brothers, husbands, wives. And I didn't want to look at anybody. And I remember feeling a tap on my shoulder. And I looked to my side, and an Israeli nurse was standing next to me. And she said to me, "You are new here, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, they just brought in my mother just 5 minutes ago into this room." And Gareth, without skipping a beat, this woman puts her arm around me and she says, "Oh, don't worry, we'll take good care of her. And if you need anything, just call my name. My name is Leah." And I broke down sobbing because One, I couldn't believe my eyes. And two, I couldn't believe people would have such compassion and such love and such a human spirit. I realized these people around me were so kind and so nice, were so compassionate. They even had something I did not even have. They were able to love their enemy and forgive them in a way that Jesus taught that we were supposed to love. And I was a Christian. And I didn't know how to love and forgive like that. Those days changed my life, Gareth. I ended up spending 22 days in that hospital. Those days changed my life, changed the way I listen to information, changed the way I listen to the radio, changed the way I listen to the news. I had to leave the hospital, but I vowed that one day I will return to Israel, that one day I would live amongst those people whose character I admired, who had something so special, who loved life so much, and they just wanted to live in peace. And I ended up returning to Israel in 1984 and working as a news anchor for World News in the Middle East, based out of Jerusalem, covering world events. And that's how I met my American war correspondent while working there, ended up getting married, and that's how I ended up coming to the United States in 1989.
It's so hard to squeeze so much of this, it's just valuable stuff to hear, into the short discussion we have. But there's so much that's going on right now that I want to hear from you about, because you are still paying attention to absolutely everything. Your organization, ActForAmerica.org, is doing amazing work on campuses, in communities, at elections, all kinds of things. Kamala Harris is just appointed or elected her vice presidential candidate. I don't know if you have any thoughts on him, if you have any thoughts on Donald Trump and JD Vance and what you think might happen in the election, how that positions you, how it positions your cause in America.
Look, I started my organization as a national security organization to protect America. When I started my organization after 9/11, radical Islamic terrorism was the only threat to the United States. Since then, we have grown as an organization and we are dealing with multiple threats. In 2001, when I started my organization, Iran was not developing nuclear bombs. China wasn't the power that it is today. Our border wasn't open as it is today. Antifa did not exist. Black Lives Matter did not exist. A lot of things have changed. So my focus has always been on national security, preserving our lives and protecting our lives. Because the job of the government is one thing: make sure the people of whatever country you live in are safe. That's the job of the government. Give us safety so we can have opportunity to build our futures, our businesses, our families, and our careers. So when I look at national security or at political people, I look at them from a national security perspective, not as a Democrat or as a Republican. When I started my organization, George Bush was in office, whom I did not even vote for him. I voted for Al Gore because I was a Democrat. George Bush was in office. George Bush came and left. Obama came and left. Trump came and left. Biden is here and he's leaving. And it doesn't matter who gets elected, whether Trump or Kamala Harris, they're going to be here for 4 years and then they're going to leave. So when I look, so I'm setting the stage saying all this because I want people to understand that what matters is security throughout the globe, international security, as well as our national security in the United States. And right now, America, under the Democratic leadership has always been weak on national security. It was Obama that signed the Iran deal, gave Iran the power to create and continue enriching uranium, which threatens the whole region in the Middle East. And if the region in the Middle East is threatened, other countries suffer. Europe, look at all the refugees in Europe, Africa, America. So what happens, the world has become so small that what happens over there doesn't stay over there. It spreads like cancer worldwide and affects all of us, good or bad. And right now it's affecting the whole world into bad because we are importing refugees that we cannot accommodate anymore. So, and I'm talking worldwide because refugees are coming to Canada, Australia, America, Europe, everywhere. And so when I look at Kamala Harris and the vice president she chose, who's very weak. They both are completely radical. They are siding with Hamas, a terrorist organization. They are sending a message to our enemies that, look, We don't really care about our allies. It doesn't matter who our ally is. We are willing to betray our closest ally, Israel, and throw Israel under the bus because we care more about our political careers and who's going to elect us. And that's why we do not want to upset that terrorist radical base. What message is that sending to all our allies? Is Britain going to trust us? Is Austria going to trust us? Is South Africa going to trust us? Is Israel going to trust? Is anybody going to trust America under a democratic leadership that sells so easily their allies under the drain for their own political careers? When you look at the Trump administration, under the Trump administration, and I know a lot of people either love him or hate him, I happen to love President Trump because of his strength. Under his administration, the world did not experience any war. Zero wars. America didn't have or start any wars under the Trump administration. Not only he did not start any wars, he actually brought peace. Look at the Abraham Accord. Who would have thought you're going to bring 50 Arab countries sitting in Saudi Arabia listening to him talk about how we're going to bring peace to the Middle East together and you're going to work together with Israel? And we saw Dubai and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and United Arab Emirates. I mean, right now there are flights between Tel Aviv and Dubai. Who would have thought we're going to get to this point? He crossed the border into North Korea and he shook the hands of the North Korean leader. I mean, we had no wars under Trump. The whole world was stable because of a strong American leadership. And right now, we need to bring back a strong American leadership under the Trump and Vance Day leadership in order to bring the world back into the tranquility button so we can sort things out because of the mess that the Democratic Party and the Biden administration has created.
I want to beg you for 5 minutes because
Sure, absolutely. I know this is taking long, but go ahead. Let's
I
continue.
mean, I could listen to you for very much longer. It's your time I'm worried about. So I have this theory about what's going on in the world at the moment, and you can probably expand on it better because you think about these things every day. You know, here in Africa, you mentioned already Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram spreading down the west and east coasts of this continent. We have populations who are being forced to convert at gun or sword point. Many people have been killed already. It's kind of a silent plague on our continent. But in Europe, they're dealing with a very different kind of thing. It's also, you know, I hear a lot of complaints from the left in America about how evil colonialism was, but they don't seem to categorize what's going on in Europe as a different kind of colonialism. And I see it as like an inverse colonialism. It's people coming from countries that are not so great, going to countries that are great and then turning them bad,
Right.
which is what colonists were accused of so many times for so many hundreds of years before this. There's that kind of colonialism going on in Britain at the moment to the degree that ordinary Britons are being told by the government that social media comments, tweets, posts will be enough to get them locked up in jail by their own police who greet the people of England by saying Salaam Alaikum, rather than God bless you. This is surely something which even the most left-wing Westerner has to open their eyes and see.
They're not seeing because they have been totally and completely brainwashed. And you know, they say an overnight success in business, they say an overnight success takes 20 years. So when you look at what's been happening around the world, the Islamists have been planning this takeover. Look, the Muslim Brotherhood wrote a plan. In 1991, we discovered the plan for North America. It's a 100-year plan for radical Islam to infiltrate and dominate the West and establish an Islamic government on Earth. In the counterterrorism circles, it became known as the Muslim Brotherhood Project. Now, the project writes in detail how they're going to do this, how they're going to get their people elected into governments on the left and on the right so they can sway policy and control governments. And we have seen this being implemented worldwide. And they have patience. Remember, the killer of Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands that wrote a letter and pasted it on his chest, talked about Andalusia, talked about Spain, that he's taking revenge for Spain. We're talking 500 years ago, 5 centuries. We in the West are thinking in the 5 second term. Oh my gosh, my internet did not load in 5 seconds. My computer is so slow. What's wrong with the internet? These people think in centuries. Not in decades. We're the fast food generation. I want it now. I want it now. I want to drive through the fast food line. I want to be able to get my hamburgers in under 2 minutes standing in line at the drive-through at the window. We want everything now, immediate gratification. These people come from cultures where they have patience, patience. They can sit there and wait us out. And they have proven that. So when they wrote the 100-year plan for radical Islam to infiltrate and dominate the West, they spoke in such detail on how they're going to do that. And they're doing it. They talked about how setting up organization in different countries, like for in America, for example, you've got CAIR, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Oh, how peaceful and wonderful that sounds. Yet they started as Islamic Association for Palestine. And when the FBI found out that they are raising money to support terrorism overseas after they secretly recorded them at a meeting in Philadelphia Hotel, the Islamic Association for Palestine changed their name to CAIR, Council on American Islamic Relations, to sound like, oh, it's a nothing, it's a wonderful thing, let's all work together, and we are a Council on American Islamic Relations. Now, they've got the equivalent of CAIR worldwide in every country. And so you see how they are implementing this. And you know the theory, Gareth, about cooking the frog. If you want to boil a frog, if you throw the frog in boiling water, he jumps immediately out. But the way you boil a frog is you put a frog in cold, calm, beautiful water, and you turn on the heat, and you turn on the heat slowly. And as the water warms up and warms up slowly, without the frog noticing that he's being cooked, by the time the water gets to a boiling point, the frog is too weak to jump out of the water. And in America and the West has been boiling now for 40 years without anybody paying attention. I remember in the 80s when I started covering world events, when I became news anchor for World News in Israel. I worked as news anchor from 1984 to 1989. And that's when we started seeing a rise of radical Islamic terrorism worldwide. The Achille Lauro, the TWA, Colonel Higgins getting killed, the Pan Am flights, and and I list them time after time after time after time. All the attacks against the West, where America hit the snooze button and thought, oh, they we started seeing terrorist attacks on every continent on the globe, and every country came up with excuses. Nobody connected the dots, and so I realized very early on in the 80s that radical Islamic terrorism was on the march, especially after the establishment of the Ayatollah came to Iran in 1979, but the world was not paying attention. And so we've got the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, 2010s. We passed the 2020s, and now we're heading into the 2030s, almost 50 years. This has been going on 50 years. That's why our new generation of brainwashed brats, who are from the generation of instant gratification, who are getting their news from their iPhones, from Comedy Central, and TikTok, think that's actually valid news. They live on this thing. And that's why they are being totally brainwashed. They do not know anything about history. And you know what they say? Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it.
Can't think of a better way to end the interview, even though I don't want to. Brigitte Gabriel, you are an absolute force of nature. It's such a pleasure to have some of your time today. I wish you luck
Thank you.
and support for all the things that you stand for. And I hope that there are, among the people listening and watching this today, a few of every kind and background and ethnicity and religion who may just think twice about something that they believed was gospel before this, and may give you a second thought, and buy your books and pay attention to what you're doing online, because you know what? If you could change one person's mind, you're doing a good job.
That's right. And I would love to come to South Africa. Let's organize something in South Africa. By the way, Act for America, my organization, used to have a chapter in South Africa called Act for South Africa. We had chapters in 16 countries throughout the world. So people who are concerned about what's happening in Africa, especially with Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, you can organize the way we organized in the United States. Start your own groups. I'm very active. Go to actforamerica.org right now. Check us out. You can send an email. at info@actforamerica.org and start something in your own community. We have to protect our civilization. We have to protect our Western values. And we have to come together as good people who care about truth coming out, who care about free speech, who care about safety and security for all people, from all faiths, from all colors, from all genders. We want everyone to live in harmony throughout the world. And the only way we can ensure that is when good people come together and speak up against evil and stop it in its tracks. Thank you for having me with you today.
Thank you, Brigitte.